Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. We are going to wrap up some plagues today. I'm Daniel Emery Price, joined by Chad Bird. Chad, you ready to get through these plagues?
Hey, Daniel. Yes, sir. I am. Let's see. We finished 9. One more to go. Chapter 11 of Exodus, I think is where we're going to pick up. We got the 10th plague, and you really can't talk about the 10th plague, of course, without talking about the Passover, and you can't talk about the Passover without talking about the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So our plate is full today. We got a lot of good stuff to get to.
Yeah. Let's get into it, man. This is the big one, and there's going to be a lot to talk about.
Yeah, there is. You know, so this 10th plague, you can kind of look at it from two different perspectives. You can look at it from the Israelite perspective, and you can look at it from the Egyptian perspective. And you kind of use a geography image, if you will, to summarize this 10th plague. So if you're an Israelite, then this 10th plague brings you up to the top of the mountain. You've been like climbing through these first 9 plagues, and you're about to get to the summit. But if you're an Egyptian, then you've been going down and down through each of these 9 plagues, and you're about to hit rock bottom. So this 10th plague is certainly the crowning point, but it just depends on your perspective as to whether that's good or whether that's bad, because it's going to be great for the Israelite, because this is going to mean liberation for them. But if you're an Egyptian, this is going to be the low point of the nation's history. I mean, the nation's history throughout the history of the world. This is the lowest point in Egypt's history that's coming up here in chapter 11 and 12. So we've been building to this for quite some time. If you listen to the last couple programs, you know that the 10 plagues are the first 9 plagues are really divided into 3 different sets of 3. And there's a certain pattern, a certain rhythm that these first 9 plagues follow, but then the 10th is set apart. It's unique in lots of different ways, both in the people that it affects, as well as how this connects with Israel's upcoming liberation. So here's chapter 11 basically is all about what the 10th plague is going to do. We don't get to the 10th plague actually until chapter 12, later in chapter 12. But chapter 11 of Exodus tells us what's going to happen. So here's how it begins. This is verse 1. The Lord said to Moses, "One more plague I will bring on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go from here. And if he lets you go, he will surely drive you out of here completely." So God had already told Moses way back at the burning bush, actually, back in Exodus chapter 4, that he was going to take the life of the firstborn sons of Egypt. He didn't say anything about the other plagues, but he did say that he was going to do that. So Moses kind of has an inkling of what's coming up here. God had already talked about the severity of the plague that is to come. And now he's told that once this one hits, then Pharaoh is finally going to relent, and he's going to not just let you go. He's not going to say, "All right, you're free." He's going to drive you out, get rid of you completely. And then he goes on. He says that he wants the people to go to their Egyptian neighbors, for the women to go to their neighbors and to ask for articles of silver and articles of gold. So not only are they going to leave, they're not going to leave impoverished. They're going to actually leave with at least a little bit of a paycheck from all of their decades of servitude there in Egypt. This is kind of like one huge paycheck that Israel is going to receive from Egypt for all of their years of unrequited labor. And the people, remarkably, are going to give this freely. In fact, it says the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and that Moses was greatly esteemed in the land of Egypt, both in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of the people. You know, it's funny. You kind of get the impression that in an unexpected way, through all of these plagues, that Moses has gained respect from the Egyptians. He's become greatly esteemed, so that really, it's like the only person left in the whole land of Egypt who doesn't really get it, who doesn't esteem Moses, doesn't really understand that, you know what, God is working through Moses. The only person who doesn't realize all this is thick-headed and hard-hearted Pharaoh. It's like he is the only one who doesn't really finally understand what's going on. So the people favor the Israelites. They greatly esteem Moses, and they hand over all of this these riches to them. And then when we get to verse 4 of chapter 11, it's when God now explicitly says what this final decisive plague is going to be. He says, about midnight, I am going out into the midst of Egypt. Notice who? It's I. So this is God himself is going to visit Egypt. And all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die. From the firstborn of the Pharaoh who sits on the throne to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the millstones, and all the firstborn of the cattle as well. So we've got the human dimension, but we also have the animal, the beastly dimension here. It's not going to be just the firstborn of people, but the firstborn of the cattle as well, which the Egyptians held as sacred. They invested divinity in some kind of bovine sort of gods and goddesses. So God is going to strike the firstborn, not only of man, but a beast as well. And as a result, there's going to be a great cry in all the land of Egypt, such as there has not been before, and such as there shall never be again. So that, like I said earlier, this is the lowest point in Egyptian history. This is the greatest cry that ever arose from any kind of suffering that takes place in the land of Egypt. Why the firstborn? Well, that's another thing that God had already clarified. This is way back in chapter 4 when Moses was still standing there at the burning bush. It says that he's going to say to Pharaoh, this is Exodus 4, chapter 4, verse 22, "Thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I said to you, let my son go that he may serve me, but you have refused to let him go. Behold, I will kill your son, your firstborn." So this is kind of a measure for measure that's taking place. Israel is always understood to be God's firstborn. He is his special acquisition, his special child. And because his firstborn had been mistreated, then God was going to respond in punishment toward Egypt by doing the same to their firstborn. And this is where he then makes the distinction back to Exodus 11, verse 7. It says, "But against any of the sons of Israel, a dog shall not even bark." That's a great image there that, you know, all of this catastrophic death is going to befall Egypt when God goes through to destroy the firstborn. But among the Israelites, not even a peep out of one of the dogs. Everything's quiet. Everything's peaceful. Everything is safe. And in this way, they're going to realize that God makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. And then it kind of wraps up the chapter by saying the Egyptian, the servants of the Pharaoh are going to come and bow themselves down before God and before Moses, and going to beg them to go out. So it's kind of the prelude to what's going to happen here. God says, "All right, the time has come, and here's what's about to happen, and here's why it's going to happen, and here's everything that's going to go down as this transpires." So that's chapter 11, kind of bringing everything now up to focus that we're going to see actually transpire in chapter 12.
Man, there's so many things that you wanna say about this, and I am trying to figure out, like, okay, where do you bring this stuff in, right? because it's brutal, man. This final plague is you know, which is not even so much a plague as it is just this wrath of God that is about to come down, not in a way that manifests itself in like pestilence or famine or some kind of natural disaster or something like that, but in just the actual execution of the firstborn. I think this is one of those things where you're like, man, God, is this like, how about, how about just Pharaoh's son? That'd probably be enough. Like, you gotta like kill everyone. Like, you gotta kill the firstborn, everything. And I think that is a tough question to wrestle with. I mean, as you read this, you're like, man, this, like, God is going pretty harsh here. And I think that the way that you have to look at this sort of stuff, I mean, as a theologian of the cross, the plagues brought upon Egypt culminating in death. So all of these things that are horrible, I mean, boils and, you know, all of that stuff, darkness, the Nile turning to blood, whatever it is, all these things that are make things physically difficult and that are things that are hard to endure. All of this, I think, sort of points you to the sufferings of Christ and what he will ultimately do to take away the sins of the world in the flesh, right? Christ's suffering isn't merely, they didn't just like take him, condemn him, and then nail him to a cross. But there's a lot of anguish that goes on during, you know, first he's beaten and flogged and mocked and ridiculed and then brought back up and tried again and then brought back down and put, you know, crown of thorns on his head, all this stuff had to carry his own cross while after being beaten to a pulp through the streets up to Calvary to eventually finally die. And I think that you kind of see that in the plagues as of like, what is God's response to sin and what ends up being required. And it's not as simple as, well, I'll just kill Pharaoh's son real quick in his sleep. Like, no, but there's like all this anguish and suffering that leads up to finally the last thing that God does, which is the death of the firstborn, which of course, you know, Jesus is the only Son of God. And so I think that's what it's trying to, the picture is trying to paint, the message is trying to get across, that what Christ will ultimately suffer for the sins of the Jews, for the sins of the Egyptians, for the sins of me and you, involves more than just, you know, it wasn't as though God said, I'll put the sins of the world on Christ and then kill him in his sleep. There's actually a ton of suffering that goes on. And so in that way, the death of the firstborn as a picture of what ultimately happens to Christ is actually milder. It's not more extreme than what actually happens to Christ.
Yeah, I agree with everything that you said. The plagues and in other parts of the Old Testament where you have a great slaughter that takes place, but we'll just kind of restrict ourselves right here to the plagues. These plagues are not understandable apart from the death of God. Everything that happens here in these plagues is not just a foreshadowing, but in some kind of strange way derives its meaning, its significance by its connection to the death of Christ, so that you can't read these chapters rightly without imposing over the top of them kind of a picture of the crucifixion. Because you kind of have to read the Bible backwards in this way. So you read all of these chapters from Exodus about the plagues after having read the account of Christ's crucifixion. And then, just to kind of continue this, you look through Christ's crucifixion to the end of all things, when there will be another great, great destruction. In fact, Revelation describes the end time judgments with language and imagery that's taken from the 10 plagues of Exodus. So you kind of look at all three of these together. You look at the plagues, you look at the death of Christ, you look at the end time judgments that will come, that wrap up the history of the world. And all three of these are kind of a unit that derive their meaning, their significance from the death of Christ. The plagues point forward to it. The end time plagues or judgments or destruction point back to it. Everything in the death of Christ is what really makes sense out of all of these other destructions. And so the plagues are a foreshadowing of the crucifixion, in the same way that the crucifixion is a foreshadowing of the end times. It's, again, as is so often the case, it's only the cross that clarifies the rest of biblical history, because it's only there that we really see a revelation of what God is up to in the plagues and what he will be doing at the end of the world. The cross clarifies all of biblical and all of really world history by revealing the kind of God we have, what he does in order to take care of sin, and how that then reveals his heart to all of us as the one who actually takes all of evil and all of the plagues upon himself in order that we might be redeemed.
Yeah,
so,
man.
Some good cross theology of the cross stuff in the plagues. So,
and that's just going to continue as this whole thing. Yeah. I mean, this picture gets very vivid, but I think even just on the front end, before we get into the nitty gritty of it, which paints, you know, a really clear picture, I think, of the death of Christ. I think even everything that we've looked at so far leading up to this pronouncement of this is what's going to happen is still only rightly viewed through the lens of the cross.
Right. Yeah. You know, what we're going to see in chapter 12 is kind of a twofold way of looking at the significance of Christ's death. And you can look at it from the perspective of the plague, the death of the firstborn, but then you also look at it from the other lens, and that is the Passover lens. So just like, you know, I wear glasses, I got two lenses here, and these two lenses help me to see by working together. Well, both of these, the death of the firstborn as well as the Passover itself, they work together to give us a full picture of what all is involved with the death of the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world. So let's get into it. Chapter 12. So I don't know how fast or slow we're going to be able to move here, but we'll proceed along here. And there's a lot of details that we'll try and clarify as we work our way through. But the first part of chapter 12 begins to give us some details about how the Passover is to be celebrated. So chapter 11 told us, hey, here's what's going to happen. Here's what I'm going to do. This is what the plague is going to consist of. But it doesn't happen right away, because Israel has to get ready for the 10th plague. And this is the beginning then of how they get ready. So God speaks to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt. That's the way the chapter begins. And first of all, we have a clarification of how Israel from henceforth is to understand time, how they are to orient themselves just according to the way that their calendar is going to function as sort of the guiding principle for their worship life. It says this month, God says, this month shall be the beginning of months for you. It is to be the first month of the year to you. So you got, of course, the Israelite calendar is not like our calendar. Of course, we start in January, But you kind of have, you really have two different calendars operative in the ancient world and in Israel as well. You've got, and neither of them start January 1st. You got some reckonings, some evidence of a calendar in the Old Testament that actually begins in the fall. And then you have some evidences of a calendar, such as here in Exodus 12, of the beginning of the year falling in the spring. There's more occurrences, more references to an understanding of the year where it begins in the spring, in the month that's known by a couple of different names, Aviv, as well as Nisan. So this is their equivalent of our January. Starts in the springtime, starts during barley harvest. It starts in this month that's known by a couple of different names. The older name is Aviv, and then Nisan is a name that came later on that was borrowed from the Babylonians. So this is the Israelite calendar. And it's significant that their year starts, this is the genesis of the year, begins with the month of the Passover. Now, why is this important? Because the Passover is the moment of new creation for Israel. This is their moment of redemption. This is their moment of liberation. This is their moment when God acts in order to redeem them. So this month is going to be not just kind of the way things get started in the year, but this month is going to define who Israel is and what kind of God that Israel has. He's the God of redemption. He's the God of the redeeming blood of the Lamb. So that's the way their year is going to start in this month of Passover. And then we get more specific about time. He says that on the 10th of the month, so this is the first month in the springtime, and on the 10th of this month, they're to choose the sacrifice. And this could be we almost always think of the Passover sacrifice as a lamb, but it actually could have been a goat. So it can be either a lamb or a kid, a baby sheep or a baby goat. It could be either one. It was almost always in subsequent history a lamb, but it says here that it could be either one. So that on the 10th of the month, they're to pick out the sacrifice, the animal that they're going to sacrifice. And they're supposed to keep it for 4 days. So there's this gap. They choose it on the 10th, and the 10th was a significant day for the Israelites. It was on the 10th of the month that Yom Kippur took place. It was on the 10th of the month that Joshua crossed over the Jordan into the Promised Land. So the tenth day is significant for the Israelites. So they choose it on the 10th, they keep it to the 14th. So for 4 days, you can kind of picture the Israelites. I like to think of it as kind of a time for preparation and reflection upon what God is about to do. You got these 4 days in which you've isolated this animal, you're keeping it separate, you're getting it ready for sacrifice. And so for 4 days, you're prepared for what God is about to do. So you don't just go out to the flock and grab one and bring it in and sacrifice it. There is this time of preparation. It's kind of like, you know, the Holy Week that the Christians celebrate. You know, there's this time of preparation where Christ enters on Palm Sunday, and then he is the sacrifice on Good Friday. And between that Sunday and that Good Friday is a time of preparation and anticipation for what he is about to accomplish. And so this is kind of like that for the Israelites. The animals to be unblemished, a male, a year old. They keep it from the 10th to the 14th, and it all leads up then to what's going to happen at twilight, so on the evening of the 14th day. Am I missing anything? There's a whole lot more that I can say at this point, but
for the sake of trying to keep it moving, I think that that's That's enough to ponder.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll keep going then. So I've made it through about the first six verses here. So we've got a kid or a lamb. We got the animal chosen. We know that it's 1 year old. We know that it's a male. We know that it's unblemished. You can't go out there and choose the run of the flock. That never was allowed. This was to be as close to perfect an animal as you could choose. And the reason for that is pretty obvious, because this animal that was about to be sacrificed, that was about to have its blood painted on the doorpost and the lintel, that was actually going to be cooked and consumed by the Israelites. This animal was the prefigurement of the sacrifice that was to come. So Christ himself is unblemished. He's whole. He is undefiled. He is the perfect sacrifice. And yet, just like this lamb, so with Christ, what happens is the sacrifice bears the brunt of someone else's problem. So our problem is sin. The Israelites' problem was their captivity. And all of this then ends up being placed on this unblemished sacrifice. And that blood, that innocent blood, is shed in order to redeem those who were enslaved and those who were guilty. So throughout the Old Testament, you always have a very strict guideline for unblemished animals being used to sacrifice. If you tried to bring a crippled animal for sacrifice, or an animal that was blind in one eye, or an animal that was the runt of the litter, so to speak, then the priest would meet you at the temple and would send you packing. There is no way that a priest would allow that kind of animal to be sacrificed, because it would send a message about sacrifice that was completely contrary to that which God intended these sacrifices to give. And that is that each one of them in their perfection, in their unblemished state, was pointing forward to the sacrifice to come. So unblemished animal, and they are to, it says, to kill it at twilight. They take some of the blood, they catch it in a basin, and they take some of the blood from the animal and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses in which they're going to eat it. Now we'll come back to that in a second. And not only are they to do something with the blood, but they shall eat the flesh of the animal that same night, roasted with fire, and they're to eat it with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs. And then we get very specific here. It says, don't eat any of it raw or boiled with water. There's only one way that you can cook it: roasted with fire. And no leftovers. You shall not leave any of it over until morning, it says. But whatever is left of it in the morning, you shall burn with fire. And one more verse, and we'll go back and talk about some of this. Verse 11 says, we have all these specifics. So we have how you're to cook it, where you're to eat it, what you do with the blood. But there's even more, because you're only going to enjoy this meal dressed in a particular way. This is verse 11. Here's how you're supposed to eat it: with your loins girded. That's old language for you're lifting up the long robe that you would have been wearing and tying it in such a way that it's more like shorts that you're wearing. But if you're getting ready to run somewhere, if you're wearing a long robe and you're trying to run, you can't do it. So if you're going somewhere in a hurry, then you gird your loins. That is, you say, you pull up the robe and bind it in such a way with a belt around your waist that you'll be able to, your legs are free, you can run. So that's what it means when you gird your loins.
They would do this when they were going to go into battle, right? Sort of a battle for gird up your loins. Where we're going to go fight, and you don't want to go fight in a dress.
Yeah.
So that's that's not me being sexist. It's not about that. It's just about, it's not the proper attire.
I mean, if you try and picture a woman with a long skirt trying to run, and then if you picture a woman with shorts on trying to run, well, it's a completely different picture because you got freedom of movement. And it was customary back then for all people to wear the long robes. And so it's getting your way if you're trying to fight or to rush somewhere or to run with this long robe flapping at your ankles. And so you lift it up, you tie it in such a way that your legs are free so that you can actually move quickly where you need to go or fight the battle that's coming up.
That's my go-to text when people are like, why don't you wear like vestments? I'm like, man, I look at going into the pulpit like I'm going into battle. My loins are girded up. I got to have freedom.
My loins are girded.
I got to have freedom. I'm
ready for battle. That's good.
I have nothing against vestments. It's a joke. It's strictly a joke. No one unsubscribe. It's a joke.
I have seen people stumble in vestments when they get when they get caught walking up a step or something.
Yeah.
So, yeah. There's something to that being having your loins girded, ready to go. And not only that, but sandals on their feet. So no standing inside your house barefooted. You got sandals on your feet, staff in your hand. And I love all these particulars. And you can't dilly-dally around when you're eating it. You're supposed to eat it in haste. So you got to dress the right way with your loins girded. Make sure you got your shoes on because we don't want somebody, you know, hang on, we'll leave my sandals on first. Where did I put them? You know, I can't find them. No, put them on your feet. Get your staff in your hand. And with your other hand, eat in a hurry. Because why? Well, you're getting ready to lead. It says, and this is the way it finishes up. This is the end of verse 11. It is the Lord's Passover. Well, there's a lot here to talk about. I don't want to drag us along too slowly, but we can't pass up some of these aspects of the Passover because keep in mind this Passover section here in chapter 12 is basically the whole Bible shrunk into one chapter. I mean, there's hardly anything in Exodus 12 that doesn't in some way intersect with what's come before it, beginning of Genesis 1, or what comes after it, going all the way to the end of Revelation. This Exodus 12 is kind of the whole Bible, the whole biblical picture of creation and redemption and the last day and the work of Christ compressed into this one single section.
Right down to the name that he gives it, right?
Yeah, right down to the name. You know, it's Passover. But I mean, there's the Hebrew word is Pasach or Pesach. Pasach is the verb. Pesach is the noun. And the typical way that's been explained, although there are other explanations, but I think the most straightforward one is when you Pasach, you pass over. In fact, this is going to come up later in verse 27. He says it's the Passover sacrifice to the Lord who passed over, who pasached the houses, the houses of the sons of Israel. So there is this idea, there's this image of God passing over these homes that held the Israelites because they were covered in the blood of the Lamb. So even the name itself is a foreshadowing of the work of Christ, as well as the Lord's Supper, which we'll want to get to as well. Now I want to bring us back to some of the details here. Why was he so concerned, for instance, about how you're supposed to eat it? Well, because it was customary in some pagan religious practices for sacrifices of animals to be eaten either raw, so that the blood was consumed with the meat, or to eat them boiled, and so to shield the Israelites from any pagan connotations, the meat of the lamb was to be roasted with fire. So this is barbecued lamb. That's the only way that it was allowed to be consumed, and the blood was supposed to be used in a very specific way. the hyssop is not mentioned here. It's mentioned later in the chapter, but a plant was called the hyssop, which had perfect structured in such a way that it made a good sponge, a paintbrush, if you will. And so the hyssop would be used as a paintbrush to dip into these basins of lamb blood or goat blood. And then that was used to paint the door frames and the lintel of the homes, inside of which the families dressed and ready to leave would be consuming the barbecued flesh of the lamb. Now, you simply have to look at all of this from the broader perspective of the work of Christ. I mean, there is so much rich Christology here every time I've taught this chapter so many times, and every time I go back over it, I'm amazed at the way in which God structured the Passover so as to give us this beautiful picture of everything about the work of Christ, and not just about what he did, but then how he gives his work to us in a very tangible sort of way. So just think about this for a moment. Not only is an animal sacrificed for you, but the very blood that was shed for you is now your shield. It protects you from the wrath to come. It protects you from death and from destruction. So that if you are behind the blood of this sacrifice, then nothing can harm you. Not a dog will bark. I mean, not a peep will be made. You are so safe when you are shielded by the blood of the sacrifice that even the wrath of God passing through will not touch you. So that is us shielded by the blood of the Lamb, that nothing can harm us, absolutely nothing, because we are safe behind the blood of that sacrifice. And not only that, but I think what's most remarkable about this sacrifice is not just that it's made and not just that the blood is painted on the doorframe and on the lintel, but the people consume the very price of their redemption. So the very meat of the one who died in their stead, the very body of the lamb that was sacrificed, is now consumed by them, so that the price of their redemption becomes part of their bodies. And this, of course, is exactly why Jesus instituted his supper, the new Passover, in the context of the Passover meal. When he said to his disciples, you know, drink of it all, this is my blood, or take, eat, this is my body, he didn't do that at any other time than the Passover, so that it might be, that there's no possible way for us to miss this. Because what the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world, what Christ is doing is he is feeding us and giving us to drink the very price of our redemption. So the body that was sacrificed for us is now consumed. And we have it better than the Israelites, because now the blood that was poured out for us is taken into our bodies, so that in the most incredibly tangible way, God gives to us the price that was paid in order that we might be set free. And all of this is foreshadowed way back in the time of the Passover.
Man, look at that. We are not going to get through the Passover, but you know, I think we've set it up. The table, as it were, is set. I think that we're going to see next week the people of Israel are going to implement these things, and God's going to make good on his word. Yeah, man, I had a feeling it was going to be tough. There's just too much there.
I need to, you know, next time. I'm going to gird up my loins so I can do a little faster.
It's not, hey, I don't, hey, we didn't create this podcast so we could move quickly. We just wanted to move.
Too many riches here to go too quickly.
That's right. Well, guys, that is good news in the midst of some absolutely horrific events. But such is the Christian life, that as death and destruction are all around, that there is, that God has made a way for us to be protected and preserved in the midst of it. So thank you guys for hanging out, and we will see you next week.